Imagine you're walking through the Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center out near Washington Dulles. You've gone past the SR-71 Blackbird, past the Concorde, past a shuttle orbiter the size of a house. You've been on your feet for 2 hours and you think you've seen everything worth seeing. And then you stop, because hanging there in one of the side bays is something that doesn't quite make sense, a float plane. A Japanese float plane roughly the size of a fighter, with a big radial engine and wings that fold in a very particular way, and a large float hanging under its belly. Clean lines, almost elegant, in that wartime utilitarian way, and you think to yourself, what is that doing here? I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this story starts at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, and it takes a while to come up. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. The airplane hanging in that bay is an Aichi M6A Zeran. The name translates loosely from Japanese as Mountain Haze, and it is the only one in existence anywhere on this planet. The last survivor of a program so technically audacious and ultimately so futile that it reads more like a war novel than history. To understand the Zeran, you have to understand the submarines, because the submarines are the whole story. In 1942, the Imperial Japanese Navy began construction on the largest submarines the world had ever seen. They were called the Sentoku class. The Americans designated them I-400. Each one measured over 400 feet in length, longer than most destroyers of the era. They displaced nearly 6,500 tons when submerged. Nothing in any navy, anywhere, came close. They were not built to hunt convoys. They were not fleet attack submarines in the traditional sense. They were built to carry aircraft. Each I-400 class submarine could carry 3 Aichi Zeran floatplanes in a waterproof hangar built directly into the forward pressure hull. The hangar was cylindrical, roughly 12 feet in diameter, running nearly 100 feet ahead of the conning tower. The aircraft were stored inside with wings folded, floats folded, and propeller blades folded flat against the engine cowling, stacked in their cradles like arrows in a quiver. Living aboard one of those submarines must have been an exercise in controlled claustrophobia, even by submarine standards. For the Zeran aircrew, it was stranger still. They were aviators. They needed sky the way the rest of us need air, and they were sealed inside a steel tube under a few hundred feet of Pacific Ocean, sometimes for weeks at a stretch, waiting for a moment of action that might last 15 minutes. When the time came to launch, the crew would flood the foredeck, drag the aircraft out of the hangar on its wheeled dolly, unfold the wings and floats, mount everything in place, and run through a compressed preflight, drilled relentlessly. The whole evolution from hangar to catapult ready came down to under 15 minutes, sometimes less, sometimes in training, under 10. Then a compressed air catapult on the forward deck would fling the aircraft into the sky, and the submarine would slip back beneath the surface before it could be spotted by anything airborne. The aircraft would fly its mission, and then it would have to find its way back to a point in a featureless ocean where a submarine would be waiting, if everything had gone according to plan, if no one was hunting them, if the sea was reasonable enough to permit a water landing and recovery. The men who flew the Zeran understood the math on that. They flew anyway. Now the airplane itself deserves its own moment, because it was a remarkable piece of engineering. The Aichi M6A was a two-seat floatplane. Pilot forward, observer and gunner aft. The engine was an Aichi Atsuda, a license-built version of the German Daimler-Benz DB601, an inverted V12, producing around 1,400 horsepower. It was an unusual engine choice for an aircraft intended for shipboard storage, because the Atsuda was finicky and required careful maintenance. But it was what Aichi had. Every single component of this aircraft that could fold, did fold. Wings folded back and inward against the fuselage. The central float folded up against the belly. The wingtip floats folded flat. The vertical stabilizer hinged down. The propeller blades folded against the nose. All of it engineered to fit inside that cylindrical hangar without wasting a millimeter of space. And when it was all unfolded and buttoned up and ready to fly, the Zeran could hit nearly 300 miles per hour. It could carry an 800-kilogram bomb, or a torpedo. Range was roughly 740 miles. Not enormous by the standards of purpose-built strike aircraft, but enough. Enough for what Japanese planners had in mind. The question was, what did they have in mind? That question had more than one answer over the course of the war, and the answers shifted as Japan's situation grew more desperate. The original concept developed in the early 1940s, centered on the Panama Canal. Think about the strategic logic for a moment. The canal was America's great logistical artery between oceans. Destroy the locks and you cripple the United States Navy's ability to move forces from one theater to another. You don't defeat America that way. Everyone understood that. But you slow the war machine, you buy time. You force the Americans to sail around South America for months while Japan consolidates its Pacific gains. A small number of submarine-launched aircraft, attacking at night, could reach Panama from the Pacific without any aircraft carrier ever appearing on the horizon. The submarines approach undetected. The sirens rise from the sea in the dark, drop their bombs on the locks, and vanish before anyone has properly understood what just happened. The I-400-class submarines were designed specifically for that reach. Two submarines, carrying six aircraft between them, represented a strike package that no one on the Allied side had thought to anticipate because no one knew it existed. Japanese naval planners spent years working toward making this happen, and they almost never got the chance. The first I-400 submarines were not commissioned until late 1944. The program that was supposed to produce 18 of them had been gutted by wartime resource shortages, American submarine attacks on Japanese shipping, and American bombing of Japanese industrial facilities. Three were ever completed. Only two would play any role in the end.
By the spring of 1945, the Panama Canal mission had been quietly set aside. American forces had swept across the Central Pacific. The strategic situation had shifted too far for a canal strike to change much, but there was another target that Japanese planners found equally compelling. At Ulithi Atoll in the Western Caroline Islands, the United States Navy had assembled a concentration of naval power that was almost incomprehensible in scale. Carriers, battleships, cruisers, destroyers, fleet oilers, and supply ships. The full logistical apparatus of the drive toward the Japanese home islands, the fleet that would support an invasion of Japan itself, moored in rows in a lagoon the Japanese knew about and couldn't touch, until now, maybe, I-400, I-401, and I-13 were assembled for a strike called Operation Storm. The Sirens would launch at night, transit at low altitude to avoid radar, and arrive over Ulithi at dawn, hit the carriers at anchor, create enough chaos to delay the invasion timetable, which Japanese planners were trying desperately to disrupt by any means available. Some historical accounts suggest that for the Ulithi mission, the aircraft were to be marked with American military markings, to avoid being identified as hostile until they were close enough to the targets to make interception difficult. If true, that would have been a violation of the laws of war. Whether that plan was actually finalized or abandoned in the weeks before the mission, the record is genuinely contested. What we do know is that the mission was preparing to launch in August of 1945, with the submarines already at sea and the aircrew working through their final preparations. And then the word came through. Japan had surrendered. Japanese Naval Command issued orders. Sarin aircraft aboard the submarines were to be destroyed. The submarines were to surface and comply with Allied direction. For some of the aircrew, the reaction was something close to grief. They had lived inside steel tubes for months. They had drilled the folding and unfolding until they could do it in their sleep, until their hands knew the sequence without their minds having to engage. They had mentally rehearsed the mission so many times that the target felt real to them in a way the rest of the world no longer did.
And now they were being ordered to push their aircraft over the side of the deck and watch them sink. Some crews painted rising sun markings on their sirens before the aircraft went into the sea. A final gesture for machines that never flew in anger. Then the aircraft went over and the Pacific closed over them, and they were gone. The I-400 and I-401 were escorted under guard to Pearl Harbor, where American naval officers came aboard and could barely believe what they were looking at. Submarines, this large, cylindrical aircraft hangars built into the pressure hull. Catapults on the foredeck, range numbers that seemed impossible, American engineers documented everything. They brought the surviving Sirens aircraft, the ones that had been stateside for testing and evaluation, to Patuxent River Naval Air Station in Maryland. American test pilots went over them. Some flights were made, carefully, briefly. Then Cold War politics intervened in a way that shaped what survived to this day. The Soviet Union and Allied power nominally was entitled under the terms of Japan's surrender to inspect captured Japanese military equipment. American naval planners did not want Soviet engineers getting a close look at the I-400 submarines. Not the hangar design, not the range capability, not the catapult systems. Those submarines represented technology that the Americans considered sensitive enough to deny. So in early 1946, rather than permit Soviet inspection, the United States Navy scuttled both I-400-class submarines in deep water southwest of Oahu. They're there still, under several thousand feet of water.
Japanese research expeditions have located them in recent decades. The Sirens that had come back to the United States were surplused, evaluated, studied, and, in most cases, eventually scrapped, as happened with so much captured enemy hardware after the war. All but one. The Smithsonian Institution acquired one Aichi M6I Siren through the chain of custody that follows wartime aircraft from service to storage to institution.
The records on exactly when and how it arrived are incomplete, as they often are. But by the 1950s, it was in Smithsonian storage, missing components, in varying states of decay.
The restoration took decades. Not continuous work. The kind of interrupted, underfunded, determined work that happens when you're restoring an aircraft for which there are almost no surviving factory drawings, no production manuals you can simply pull off a shelf, and essentially no one left alive who built the airplane or maintained one operationally. Smithsonian staff and volunteers worked from photographs, captured Japanese technical documents, measured and cross-referenced the airframe itself, and fabricated parts where originals couldn't be found. The engine was preserved in static condition, not restored to running. This is a display aircraft, not a flying one, but every major system is present. The folding mechanisms work. The lines are right. When the Udvar Hazy Center opened in 2003, the Sayron was among its centerpiece artifacts, displayed in the markings it would have carried for the Ulithi mission. A float plane that came out of a submarine and almost flew to war. Stand underneath it and try to absorb what you're looking at. This is an aircraft designed to fold itself small enough to live inside a submarine's pressure hull, to be assembled by a crew working in darkness, possibly in heavy seas, in under 15 minutes. To fly hundreds of miles from a launch point that has already slipped beneath the waves, to strike a target and then locate a submarine in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, if it could, if everything had gone to plan. The engineers at Aichi were not naive people. They were solving genuinely hard problems under extraordinary pressure. You don't have to approve of what they were building to appreciate how well they built it. And here's the thing that stays with me, back when I'm home and the Udvar Hazy experience has settled. The concept that Japan developed in 1942, submarines that extend their reach through carried aircraft, that idea didn't die with the Sayron. It evolved. The United States Navy deployed submarine-launched Regulus cruise missiles in the 1950s. The Tomahawk missile carried that logic into the modern era. The basic proposition that a submarine can reach out and touch a distant target with a flying weapon from a position that is difficult to find is woven into modern strategic naval thinking. Japan got there with a float plane and a cylindrical hangar in the middle of World War II. The Sayron never dropped a bomb in combat. It never fired its guns at a target. Its war began and ended in a submarine hangar. The aircraft that came closest to the fight were pushed into the sea by their own crews on the day the war ended. The one that survived did so largely by accident, the particular luck of being in the wrong place at the right time. When you see it at Udvar Hazy, take a minute, don't rush past it for the Concorde. Read the placard, look at those folding wing hinges, and think about the engineering that produced them. Think about the aircrew who lived beneath the sea for months, waiting for a morning that never came. The Mountain Haze. The aircraft with no combat history and the most extraordinary history of all sources for today come from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's own restoration and curatorial documentation, and from Mark Felton's detailed work on Japanese special operations programs in the Second World War. You can find more at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. That's all for the hangar. Go out there and look up.